Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Lifton, and this is episode 21 of the Pop Does Podcast. It's actually more like episode 20.5, but I'm calling it episode 21 because I can. In case you didn't read the show notes on our last episode, here's the story. When we spoke to our buddy Pete Lubin, it ended with about a 23.5-minute discussion about the current state of the music industry. And when I went to edit the show, I felt that keeping that portion in its entirety would have made the show way too long, but it was too good to try to pick the best moments from it. So I decided that I would give it to you entirely as a bonus episode a few weeks after the main one. And it's mostly between Jeff and Pete. Jason and I stay silent throughout pretty much all of it. In fact, it's such a good dialogue that at one point you'll hear Pete talk about artists having to groom themselves, and I almost butted in to make a mom joke, but I didn't want to disrupt the flow. One more thing, you'll also hear Jeff pretty early on talk about an artist that he interviewed named John Michael Ruschel, who is the frontman for the band My Name is John Michael. Last week they came through Chicago, and I got to hang out with John Michael for a little while at the place that they were playing. And he gave me permission to use his song Orphan at the end of the show, so consider that our collective endorsement for this month, and you'll hear that after the tag. And if you like it, and there's no reason why you shouldn't, you can download that song for free and another one called Elders from his website, mynameisjohnmichael.com, and there will be a link to that in the show notes. So enjoy the talk, and Jason, Jeff, and I will be back as soon as possible with our next episode. Thanks again to Pete Lubin for being our guest on the show and providing such great insight into the music industry. Visit us at popdose.com and check out our brand new design. A lot of hard work went into it, and it looks great. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at popdose. You can join our Facebook group for fans of the show, and you can also download all of our previous episodes over at iTunes. So, see you next month. Take care, everybody.
Your story and a lot of the other stories that we're talking about today are the tales of kids who were maybe not destined to be rock stars, but loved the music so much that they found a way into the industry, and they found a way to contribute, and they found a way to kind of tell stories of their own through other artists with, through their careers.
That's totally, you're totally accurate about that. For me, that's what it was for sure, yeah.
What, obviously, those kids are still out there, but it seems like the opportunities for them are, if not gone altogether, they're definitely not the same ones that they used to be. What, do you have any advice for 12-year-old kid who's in love with rock and roll right now?
Wow. You know, there is no industry anymore. It's a very hard thing to wrap your brain around, but it's true. There is no industry anymore. There is only talent and the successful purveyance of talent. And so if I was a kid, I don't know about 12, there'll be ways to be like I was or Cameron Crowe, it was the same thing, mm-hmm. whatever. But, you find talent and you grow the talent without any regard for what's known as the record industry. That would be the way to do it. And certainly the tools are there to do it with. You don't need anybody to be your own juggernaut, that's for sure. What you do need is goods that can't be found anywhere else, and that comes from unique talent.
The reason I ask is because I just a few days ago talked to the guy who's the frontman for this band called My Name is John Michael. Mm-hmm. And this is funny. It'll be funny to you and I, and to a lesser extent, Jason and Dave, because they know George Howard. Uh-huh. He's a Loyola graduate. He went to school for music business.
Right.
And took classes from George.
Right.
And walked away with all these, music business 3.0 concepts, and ended up doing this project where he on the web recorded a song a week, mm-hmm. and put them out to his fans. Which, to my way of thinking, almost makes him kind of his own A&R guy. He is the one who is doing the work to sort of separate the wheat from the chaff by by just kind of blasting his fans with all this music and getting all this feedback. And at the end of it, he had a rock solid record. It's almost like the digital equivalent of honing your craft through busking or being on the road for 5 years, you know?
Okay.
Where does the A&R guy fit?
Yeah.
In all this anymore?
He doesn't.
And where does the guy who discovers the talent fit in all this anymore?
Well,
if the talent is growing itself, if the mechanism is there.
It's like a two-pronged fork with a very sharp tip. Here's the problem. Back in the glory days, let's call it, of the record industry, A&R men served a very, very valuable function. And that function was not even so much the records that they allowed to be made, but the hundreds of thousands of records that they kept from being made. Okay? It was too expensive to enter a recording studio without a patron, and your patron was the A&R man who held the keys to the kingdom, to the studio, and said, you can come inside and we can commemorate your stuff, you know. As digital audio reared its beautiful, wondrous, ugly head, the A&R man more and more lost the ability to decide who could and couldn't make records. Now, some artists, like I would sit on the A&R panel of South by Southwest, and I would try to, you know, rile up the crowd, and eventually it would get to the point where they'd start yelling, you know, who are you to decide, you know, who gets to make records and who doesn't? And the answer is, you know, if you took your gig seriously and you were good at it and you valued your role as the gatekeeper, you know, you were, in fact, qualified to make those kinds of decisions and you were doing a service at the same time. On the other hand, I don't dismiss the possibility that brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people who haven't got a prayer of getting recognized, you know, can go make their own record and it'll be a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant record. The trouble there is, of course, you could throw a brilliant record into the ocean with the other 300,000 records in the ocean and no one would ever know. And plenty of times I think, you know, there's hundreds of Dark Sides of the Moon, you know, floating around in the Atlantic that no one's ever heard. I don't doubt that there is. But an A&R man's function now, if there is one, and by the way, we were groomed, or else we had to groom ourselves. Back in the olden days, you know, you had mentors and they passed on this sort of religion of, you know, worshiping the right records versus the wrong records and doing things for the right reasons and discerning the wheat from the chaff. It was something that not everyone, that we took seriously until more and more it was taken less and less seriously. You have to remember, and I don't get me going because I can talk on this for, you know, 10 hours straight, but as the record industry grew, the distribution pipelines, they were built bigger and bigger. And as the pipelines grew bigger and bigger, you had to fill them with more and more records. Otherwise, you lost your efficiencies of scale. So the bar for the quality of records dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. You know, that's easy to see if you... You know, if you plotted it out in your mind or anywhere else over the course of the sad demise of the record industry.
That's an interesting point. I always pinpointed it back to the big battle between Yetnikoff and Clive Davis, where they were stealing artists from each other and doling out all kinds of money to guys like Paul Simon and James Taylor. That's where I thought
that played a role, no question. Jeff, if you... The whole thing is such a perfect storm of disaster upon disaster. I'll tell you one that I deeply, deeply believe, and I'm not going to be the first one that's ever said it, but the advent of Pro Tools destroyed music, destroyed it. Because there isn't a single moment on a single recording, either one you enjoy or you don't enjoy, that's real, that ever existed in time and space, that ever actually was performed. There's not a moment.
You know, that's how I felt about drum machines in the 80s, and then the pendulum swung back the other way. Do you think that...
The Fairlight and the Kurzweil, I remember saying that back in the late 80s.
Yeah, and if you listen to those records, they sound creaky and horrible,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
These records, I think, will it ever swing back so that people say, wow, in 2005 to 10, the record sounded horrible?
Well, the drum machine is a tool, just like Pro Tools is a tool, but it was overused because people got so excited.
Here's the thing. You can go into a Pro Tools recording session with the greatest intentions on the planet. You can say, I am not going to do this or that. I am not going to cut and paste and copy and steal.
But you will.
But you will. That it will overcome you, your best intention, in a matter of hours, if not, you know, days, if not hours, or whatever. It will do it. You will succumb. And when you do, your record starts to become unreal. And when it does, you've failed to reach people.
Yeah, but you can also find people, you know, from the classical world who say the very ability to edit and overdub destroyed music. I mean, it's all part of a cycle, basically, is what I'm saying. That is technology driven. That anything that has separated the direct listening, the listener from the direct experience of listening, from physically seeing a performance to the recording mm-hmm. industry, has in essence added a layer of this has destroyed the industry.
Except here's the thing, multi-track recordings. That end up yielding, you know, Sgt. Pepper or whatever, are completely different animals than the New York Philharmonic performing Beethoven.
Right.
It's apples and oranges. However, you know, a recording by Beyoncé is not a different animal than a recording by Aretha Franklin, except that Aretha Franklin is singing on it.
Right.
Okay, so it's, you know, they're trying to pass it off as the same art form when it's, you know, a mock version of that art form.
Right, but a recording of the New York Philharmonic was not touched in the studio. It was a live thing, mm-hmm. and they did it right, and they did one take, and they got it on Columbia Records, and it went out, and it sold.
Right.
Which therefore makes it the same thing as
Tutti Frutti. No, makes it the same thing as
right.
as,
okay.
as Tutti Frutti, but not as Sgt. Pepper. Right?
Right, but that's what I'm saying. And like Sgt. Pepper came along, it's like, okay, this is this new...
Impure.
Yeah.
Well...
But there were overdubs and yeah, like the ability to multi-track. You know, each thing has added a different layer of detachment from the directness of that.
Okay, but there are certain artists that use the new recording medium as a new recording medium. For example, Jeff knows that I'm a huge fan of...
I know where you're going with this.
...of the Kleptones. I mean, that kind of approach to record making, which is wholly derived from the science and technology of Pro Tools, that is perfectly valid. It even has its antecedents, if you remember Plunderphonics from the late 80s.
Negative Land.
Or Negative Land, exactly. I mean, that branch of thinking about art, or musical art forms, is fine and dandy. I think fantastic. In fact, I'm completely overwhelmed when I hear really good stuff that is that sort of mashup-oriented stuff. Or whatever artist it is, you know, using Pro Tools in an unabashed fashion. It's when you hide behind the technology and you create this artifice that you're fobbing off as a record that was handcrafted when in fact it couldn't be farther from handcrafted. That's
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that your argument has been made for generations and generations.
I'm aware that it has.
Okay.
But I think we're stuck in this curious overlap. You know, if popular music was entirely kleptone-oriented, instead of these faux records, I'd be happy. I'd be thrilled with that. You know, but the thing is, you know, if you attend, or certainly if you head up, you know, a Pro Tools recording session, and then you spend 14 hours chopping up the breaths in between syllables. Okay. Yep. Ooh, tighten that breath up just a little bit. Oh, wait. You know, she probably needs to have breathed there, so we probably have to move that a little to the right. If you spend 14 hours creating your lead vocal track, and then you leave the studio, you go out in your car, you jump behind the wheel, you turn on the radio, and Stevie Wonder is singing, There is nothing more profoundly depressing or upsetting than that moment, okay? When you realize that track that Stevie Wonder is singing maybe was the combination of two tracks where, you know, he muffed one note and you slid between the two tracks to cover the note.
Another pass.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Not so, even. Stevie used to keep his... He used to keep his mistakes in there. I remember I was watching one of those classic albums of for Songs in the Key of Life, and they isolated the harmonica track for Isn't She Lovely, and he was pointing out all the places he screwed up.
There you go. Sure.
And he kept them in.
Sure. You know, but try to keep them in now. I mean, somebody will look at you and say, what are you, insane? You know, give me 10 minutes, go get a soda, I'll handle it. It'll be fine. You know, and Jason, drum tracks, I mean, the first thing anyone does in a session, after you've cut your basic track, the first thing that happens is, okay, everybody, lunch break while I line up the drums so that they're absolutely perfectly...
With the click.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the first thing that happens to a basic track.
Did you see the news report? Well, not news reports, but the first video clip that came out of the studio for the new Aerosmith record?
No.
They were bragging about not using a click track. That's where we are, man.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, you review a record and you're like, oh, wow, she's really singing. Or, these are real drums. Right?
Yeah, but if you heard real singing now, you might be, you know... You might start squinting a lot, you know?
I think, I really believe that on some subconscious level, and one that's difficult to really discuss without sounding really old and cranky, we can feel and we can hear what you're talking about.
I believe
that the air has been sucked out of these recordings, and then I think that it does. I think to Dave's earlier point, I think it does add a layer of distance and detachment that has kind of helped, contributed to the commodification of music for a younger generation of listeners.
Exactly, precisely. You know, it's not just how it's created, which can be a travesty, but you know, and listen, I still find it's perfectly fine. You know, when I hear a good record, I still think, good record. But
But isn't it harder to feel it?
Yeah, I don't live and die the same way I used to. Now, I'm also old and curmudgeonly, but the thing is, when you can add them to your playlist, delete them from your hard drive, when you can push on to the next thing without so much as a fare thee well, you know, everything is a mouse click, when a file doesn't even actually exist as a physical thing, when cover art is the size of a postage stamp, all of those things, all taken in toto, it amounts to one conclusion, which is that records and music just don't have the impact that they once did. Okay, it's not at the forefront of culture anymore, for a huge number of reasons, and that's why, you know, technology and smartphones and video games are at the forefront of culture, because they are more conducive to taking that position of supremacy in the culture.
Well, it does seem like that the creative, over the past 5 to 10 years, the creative people who in a previous decade would have become musicians, that they have gravitated towards creating video games and creating graphic novels.
Unquestionably, you know, yeah. And who said that before anybody? Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was asked, God, I don't know when it was, you know, would you go into music if you had it to do all over again? He said, no way, man. I go into mathematics, you know, or whatever. He said something like that. You know, that's where it's at, you know.
Plastics.
Well, but, you know, he said, you know, that technology is where the fun and excitement is, you know, not music. And God knows Bob was a guy who knew how to play the angles, so.
Yeah, one of the things that I just saw, and something that's been going through my head a lot lately, I just saw Paul McCartney here. Yeah. And somebody somewhere down the line, and it probably has already been done, and there are people who are going to write songs every bit as great as Hey Jude from now until the end of time. But we're never going to get another Hey Jude.
That's right.
Something that will just unite 50,000 people all holding hands and singing that ending together.
That's right.
Well, that's the death of the monoculture.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's all too fractured and shattered, which, you know, is a bad thing and a good thing. It's another reason why music has lost its primacy in the culture. But on the other hand, if you want to be into skateboard, death metal, Cro-Magnon, bop, you know, you can be, and you can find everyone else on the planet who is, and you can enjoy it as much as we ever enjoyed anything.
Right.
So it's fine. It's just not going to be big. And, you know, so, I mean, we all know, the era of the multi-platinum album is well gone, and it just trickles, it just goes down from there into micro covens of,
right.
of little music worshippers.
So, having said all that, we should probably start stopping making ourselves talk in the near future. I would like to ask you if, given everything that we've said, you are optimistic about music.
I'm optimistic in the sense that I know I can always enjoy it and that there'll always be ways to enjoy it, and that's not going to go away for me. I'm not optimistic that it'll ever be enjoyed by generations to come, at least not in the foreseeable future, in the way that I enjoyed it growing up, because it's, by the same token, I can't enjoy video games the way they do. So every generation has its own thing, and I'm happy for that. So I guess I'm generally okay.
All right. I get a little excited because Dave and Jason and I have talked about this in the recent past. There seems to be a kind of a mini groundswell of people who are encouraging the creation of music for the pure joy of the creation of music,
mm-hmm.
which is, I hate to say, somewhat shocking to see in the American Idol era.
Right. Well, that's a reaction to the horrifying American Idol era.
Yes.
Yeah. I heard that bit with you guys talking about hootenannies and bringing your guitar down to the local square,
mm-hmm.
and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's wonderful stuff. You know, I fell into the same thing, and probably, I mean, nothing happens by accident in some way. I mean, so I one of the things I took up in my dotage is, you know, collecting and enjoying guitars. I think it's part of the zeitgeist or whatever you want to say that I happen to, you know, gravitate toward that. I was shopping in physical stores yesterday, and there was a strip of like 7 or 8 boutique-y type shops, and not less than 4 of them had guitars incorporated into their window display.
Hmm. It's nothing but a good sign.
It's interesting, isn't it? One of them, by the way, was a genuine. The shopkeeper didn't even know because it was gifted to her, But I went in to say, can I buy the guitar instead of your dodgy merchandise? But it was a original Dan Electro signed by Link Wray.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Huh. And she said, oh, really? Is that somebody's signature? Who is that, Link Wray?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Did you buy the guitar?
She said, I'm sorry, it's not for sale.
If it was for sale, she'd be like, oh, it's nobody.
I walked in. Yeah. I walked in and I said, I'm going to ask you a question. Maybe you get asked 5 times a day. Maybe you've never been asked. She said, you want to buy the guitar, don't you? So she knew. Pop Dose. Good.
This
I'll,
is all this,
I'll put that in
now
the
hopper. Hearing all this shit that doesn't get into the show.
Okay.
This is like when you were talking about like doing... 14 hours of editing and moving breaths around and editing out things. Yeah. I was about to say, yeah, this is what I do when I edit the show.
So the show that you publish will never actually have existed. See, that's the thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly, because as it turns out, you know, somebody's track might be off-synced by, you know, a quarter of a second
right.
at some point.
Right,
you know.
Right. Well, that's a technical right. glitch. That's not the same as trying to fob off, the wrong reality.
Right.
You didn't hear the show where Dave made Jason sing Ave Maria?
Damn, no. Could you send me a link or, I want that file. I'll bet I can.
We had to auto-tune the hell out of it.
I'm sure I can do a hell of a mashup with that, you know?
Well, last night I dreamt that I was an orphan, like my father before me. He got on a boat to arrive at home. It's funny how all I want to do is leave. Well, I could steal the keys to his Cadillac and make a break for the sea. No company, no friends, no safety. I gotta find the orphan in me. Oh, I'll be too. But I'll return.